Today is Sunday, February 21, 2021. This is a Part 10 Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Richard Hanson. Last name spelled H-A-N-S-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Richard. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm good. Thank you.
Good. Richard, we talked in Part 9 about this amazing sort of revitalization of your career with the Park Service that took you all across the Pacific working on trails. That's amazing stuff that got you another 10 years in with the Park Service or so. And you retired then in 1964. Can you pick that story up and complete this off for us?
I retired in 2011, not 1964.
Sorry, you were 64.
64. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. And what did you have a going away party?
You know, when we left Olympic in Port Angeles, my wife and I, we had probably the classic going away party, because we were actually going to move over to our property here too. And
so was this in 2011, or was that
no, this was in 2000.
Right. So what happened in 2011? Did you go through that? You got two retirement parties.
Well, I did a small thing over here, very small. Because we'd done just a huge, had a 350 person party in Port Angeles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I always felt that I had my retirement party.
Okay.
And the day after I retired, or maybe the week after, I was flying off to Cuba. And so when I came back, yeah, I went up to the park, had a luncheon, and got a couple of plaques and that kind of shit. But no, it was low-key when I retired the second time, that's for sure.
Okay. What was Cuba like in 2011?
Cuba was absolutely a wonderful, wonderful place. And it's got a solid place in my heart because it was the last trip my brother and I did together. And also my nephew. And met his future wife the first time, and it was spectacular. I've always enjoyed communist or socialist countries.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, but I feel safer and more open than I do in just about any place else. I mean, Vietnam, I just walk through streets in the middle of the night. Nicaragua, Cuba. So Cuba was wonderful. The people were incredible. Their music on every street.
Wow.
Food was decent. Mm-hmm. With, you know, 50 years of sanctions and such, it was amazing to drive around and see how they organic farmed. And they've got organic farming down to a science.
Wow.
The reefs were beautiful because there wasn't cruise ships parking on them and dropping anchor on them.
Right.
History was incredible. We stayed at pensions, which are private houses.
Hmm.
And so I met some really wonderful people. this lady, her first name was Mercedes, and she was 10 or 12 years older than I, and we were on our balcony, and we were looking over the plaza, and I asked her, I said, so did the revolution work? And she said, you know, I was 16 years old when Che and Fidel, Raul, all the people came marching into the Capitol right there in the Zocalo. And she said that, yes, it really worked, but it's time for a change. Those were her exact words. She talked about the health care that they had, and schools, and very unique from some other places I've been, that even little out of the way farmhouses had electricity and power, and you know, a whole lot different scene than Nicaragua. I've been in Nicaragua when Somoza was the dictator, and I had heard about Sandinistas back then. It was like 1971 or 72, and I returned 30 years later, and very disappointed in what Ortega and the Sandinistas and such had done. But still, I mean, it was a beautiful country. But they basically went from one dictator to another dictator. And that's sad. In Vietnam, I was absolutely just blown away. They went from one of the poorest countries in the world, them and Haiti back in the 80s, to just this vibrant, stunning economy. Absolutely beautiful, beautiful, beautiful people. And they absolutely, internet everywhere. That's one thing Cuba, I think, has started to allow internet. But in Vietnam, it was any little chicken bus you might be on going out through the jungle or wherever you at, you had great Wi-Fi. And the people used it. And the people organized, especially on local levels. They thought the government was screwing up. They were free to organize and tell their side of it. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But all those countries, I'm getting away from Cuba a little bit, but Cuba itself, and the one thing that I take from Cuba also is there's a lot of ethnicity down there. Is that how you say that word? There's a lot of blacks. There's a lot of European kind, Spanish, and there's the large black population. I ask a lady, I said, is there racism in Cuba? And this is a black lady, and she said, no. She said, we're all Cubanos.
Cool.
All Cuba. And so I thought that real interesting also. But yeah, so
where else,
I didn't have a goal.
Where else did you go in the 2010 to 2020 time period? Did you travel a lot, or did you just hang in Hawaii and such?
No, I did. We did travel a lot. I did. My wife was really not interested in, well, I didn't invite her to journey back to Vietnam with me. And I made two long trips over there. the first one, I flew into Hanoi, and a place we weren't, I'd never seen before, and traveled, spent a lot of time in Hanoi, one of the great cities of the world, and traveled a lot up by the Chinese border, and Halong Bay, and up in the indigenous hill tribes, a lot of Black Hmong and Montagnards, you know, did a lot of hiking and trekking up there, and journeyed. The further south I got was Hue, and that was a place that I had been, and went and checked out a couple of battlefields.
How do you spell that? Hue?
H-U-E.
Thank you.
It was the biggest battle of the Vietnam War. It was the Tet Offensive when they came and basically that was 1968 when after that Tet Offensive where they just hit every city in the South Vietnam, including Saigon, and attacking our embassy, and the battles raged for a long period of time, and the citadel in Hue held out for 2.5-3 months. And after the Tet Offensive, there wasn't a guy in country that thought that there was ever a chance we were going to win this war. Because they just came out of friggin' everywhere, and it was just totally obvious that, you know, and that, so from 68 to 75, everybody, including the politicians, knew we were never going to win, but it was just this face-saving exercise that caused another 30,000-40,000 deaths.
Yeah. Was it cathartic for you to go back and spend time there?
Very much so. Very, very much so. one of the things I wanted to do, I don't know if I told you this, one of the things I wanted to do was to meet with a North Vietnam regular. And I called these trips to myself anyway. They were going to be my apology. You know, it was an apology tour.
Wow.
And because I've lived with the fact that it was a bullshit war. And I was a part of it. And, you know, I tried to do my part when I got back doing the demonstrations and being court-martialed and that kind of stuff. To try to say I was sorry, but so I took this little hand-carved bird out of ivory that I'd had for a long time. A guy from Peace Corps back in the 70s had brought it to me, and it was 3 inches tall, very detailed on a nice wooden base. And I said, well, I just going to give this as representation because Vietnamese love the bird. And so I organized this trip. I didn't know anybody over there. I hadn't been there in 45 years. And got online to have somebody help me get my visa and such. And she spoke fairly good English. And I said, hey, one thing I'd really like to do is meet with somebody that fought in the America's War. They call it America's War. Here we call it the Vietnam. She says, I think my father knows somebody, and I'll see what I can do. And so I'll give you the cliff notes here, bro. It was
Yeah, cool. Thank you.
Day third day I was in parents are with her. They have their scooters. I get on the back of the scooter with her father. And we journey about 15 miles out of town. And I'm thinking the whole time, this friggin' place is going to kill me yet. Because the scooters and shit over there, the traffic, it's just insane. It's just absolutely. And we pull into this compound. And they told me we've got a half an hour to 45 minutes. Pull into this compound and go to this house, real kind of, you know, it's like a step or two above what I'd been seeing. And I walk in, and here's this gray-haired old gentleman, probably in his 80s. And on the wall, the first thing I see, he's got his wife there, he's got his kids there, he's got his grandkids there, all to meet the American. And I look up on the wall, there's these huge portraits of him and Ho Chi Minh, him and General Gipp. I look over in the corner, and there's this medal, or this case with just a ton of medals in it. And I just go, fuck, I'm out of my league here. You know? I mean, I was a friggin' private, and I'm looking up, and here this guy. And he come over, and he just gave me, and I'm pretty emotional. And I wear my feelings on my sleeve. Mm-hmm. And he comes over and he just gives me this massive hug. And then he points to the couch. And he starts walking me over to the couch and I can see that he's lost a leg. And we sit on the couch and I take out my little bird. And I just start crying like a fucking baby. Like a fucking baby. And I hand him this. And he sees that, I'm pretty emotional. And he just grabs me. And just hugs me so friggin' hard. And I felt totally like this immense friggin' relief. Because I didn't buy a ticket with a return date. I was going to see how things went. I was going to make this little gift. And then if, you know, I got a fuck you, American, you know, this kind of attitude, I would have flown back, you know. And say, okay, I've done what I came to do. But this guy was just totally amazing. We talked, only thing about war that we talked about is I asked him how he had lost his leg. And he had lost it in a major battle that it turned out my brother was at. And it was a battle, Vietnamese call, the Battle of the Screaming Souls. Mm. And I go, wow, we call ours Hamburger Hill. The Battle of the Screaming Souls. He says, yeah, you can go out there today, he says, and you can still hear them. And he had got hit with mortar. And it wasn't bad, kept on fighting. But he had to be evacuated up the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which took him a little over a month to get from where he got hit to where he could get antibiotics and get some help in Hanoi. Mm. And by the time he got there, they he said they were cutting off 6-8 inches every 4 or 5 days during the journey. But he wanted to know about, one of his real poignant questions to me was, how does America treat their veterans? And I wasn't there to bash America. I wasn't there, and I just told him straight out, you know. I said, well, not very well. Said the homeless rate with veterans is twice the national average, suicide rate the same. You want to go to a veterans hospital, sometimes you might have a month or more before you can make an appointment. I just, you know, and he just, he about started crying. So we got that kind of out of the way, and we were just sitting there talking, and I hear this commotion coming from another room of the house. And I look at my interpreter, the nag, and I said, what's the matter? And she says, well, you gave them a beautiful gift, and he had taken this bird and put it right in front of his case of medals. You know, I mean, and he had some friggin' salad. And he had been at it a long, long time. And she says, now they have to give you something. And I said, no. I said, I'm not taking anything. She says, you're going to have to. Hmm. And they brought me in this beautiful plate with a very serene scene, Vietnamese rice paddy, stilted house, beautiful lady, and then all the writing around it. And I said, can you read this for me, Nagweed? And she looked at it and she goes, oh, wow. She said, this is what he was presented when he lost his leg. And I said, fuck, I can't take that. There's no fucking way I take that. And she just says, you have to. So I did. We ended up staying probably 3.5-4 hours.
Wow.
Instead of the 35 minutes we were allotted. And he was just, I called him Santa Claus. He was just fucking incredible. He had fought the French. That's where he got to know Ho. He'd been at Dien Bien Phu. He fought the Americans, and he told me we knew America was coming the day the French left, and we spent 2 years preparing for it before America came in. They fought the Americans. He was the head guy in the Vietnamese army that went into Cambodia and overthrew Pol Pot. Because a lot of Vietnamese were living in Cambodia at that time, and they had had enough of the genocide.
Yeah.
And so they had gone in there, and then he fought the Chinese in the border war of 1979, 1980. When China just came across the border, and what he told me, Mr. Trom told me, was that defeating America had given them a reputation in Asia, Southeast Asia, that there was no quit in them. And so when they met at the border, Chinese came in, and they got about 30 miles into Vietnam, and they were only, so that would mean they were only about 50 miles, 60 miles from Hanoi. And they had, I guess, a couple of really fallacious battles, and China went back across the border and hasn't been back. So this guy had been around, and this guy had been, and I just looked at him, and I just go, you know, I'm sitting here a fucking mess after being in for 3.5 years. Mm. This guy fought for 45 years. But he was on the right side, you know. So yeah, it was, you know, very, very cleansing, very, cool. Very nice. And I went down to Hue and I flew back. And 2 years later, I went back and flew into Ho Chi Minh, Saigon, and thought I'd spend some time where I had been. And where brother had been. And that trip turned into, I don't plan anything when I travel. You know, it's like, okay, I plan maybe 2 days ahead of, you know, what I'm going to be doing.
Okay.
And went to a few places. Got all kind of emotional. Went down to the Mekong Delta, where it pours into the China Sea, South China Sea, and hopped on a little boat. Looked around there because I'd been down there, and brother had spent a lot of time in the Delta. You know, just absolutely blew my mind. I forgot how harsh it was down there. And then I heard about a ferry that runs up into Phnom Penh. And I just told myself, shit, let's try to stay as long as we can on this river. And I spent 3.5 weeks, 4 weeks traveling up the Mekong in all kinds of different boats, rice haulers, a ferry now and again, a fast boat, a slow boat, and made it all the way from the South China Sea, Mekong Delta itself, up into Myanmar.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know how many clicks that was. I think I've looked at a map. I think it's close to 800, and met some fabulous people. Spent a couple of 3 weeks in Cambodia. Went from Phnom Penh up the Tolo Sap River to Angkor, and spent a week running around Angkor Wat, which was just incredible. And still, and you know, then the other big emotional deal was the Killing Fields.
Ooh.
I mean, just absolutely insane.
Hmm.
And I was there with a guy whose father-in-law was killed there, spoke good English, tuk-tuk driver, became friends with him, would just tuk-tuk around Angkor, Phnom Penh, and then at Vientia in Laos, I hopped back on the fucking river and went through Laos, spent a couple of 3 weeks in that spectacular country. That was the only place where I felt some hostility. And we had carpet bombed Cambodia and Laos for a couple of years. Neither one of them had a dog in the fight. But, you know, the Ho Chi Minh Trail ran through Laos and into Cambodia and around, and so we didn't let borders stand in our way. And there's still a lot of unexploded ordnance in Laos. And some people there were fairly bitter, you know, that people were still getting their legs blown off, you know, 35, 40 years later.
Right.
And, yeah, and, you know, we did nothing to help clean it up. I think a but hazmat too, and Vietnamese, they, you know, they're just super fun sites all over the where we left them, you know. And so got all that out of the way. Spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia, and was planning on another trip to take some of brother's ashes back there. He was too sick to go the second time. First time he wanted me to go and feel it out. I came back just going, hey, fuck, man, you know, you gotta go. He says, okay, next time. And he was too sick to go the next time, and then he died not too long after that. And a casualty of the war still, Agent Orange, PTSD. He said he wanted to, nothing like a brother to send you on a world tour with his ashes. What do you want your ashes, you know? What do you want your ashes? He says, well, I'm taken back to Vietnam. Want some up on the Snohomish River. Need some over in Maui. You know, need a few fucking at Safeco Field in Seattle. You know, so but you had about 10 places, and I've gotten to 7 of them.
Wow.
And his has gotten to a couple, and the only place left was Vietnam. And then my wife got hurt. And so traveling has, you know, been put on hold for a while. And then the pandemic.
Tell me what happened to Che.
To Chu?
Yeah.
My wife?
Yes.
She fell off the roof here at the farm. I was standing right there holding a ladder.
When was that?
June of 2019.
Okay.
About 17, 18 months. She stepped on the ladder, and the ladder just started folding in.
Ooh.
And she went thud. I knew exactly what had happened. She was unconscious for, and all this shit, man, it's like flashes you back. You know, I was a medic in Vietnam,
right.
and that came in pretty handy a couple times in the Grand Canyon, but I knew exactly what had happened.
Hmm.
And, we're a tough place to get an ambulance to. It's four-wheel drive, but by God, those guys made it, and took about 40 minutes to get here. She was conscious, and, you know, there was definitely no feeling. And so she got air-evac to Honolulu in Queens Hospital. Helicopter air-evac. We were over there for about 6 weeks in Honolulu. And then we got accepted to the University of Washington's spinal rehabilitation place in Seattle.
Wow.
And we were there for 3.5-4 months. So it was a long journey. But by God, even by the first week at Queens, we were laughing more than we were crying.
Hmm.
And we've tried to stay that way. You know, there's no doubt that it was a blink of an eye, life-changing event. That, you know, I think none of that shit will ever happen to you, but by God, don't blink or it will.
Right.
So our days are up here are good. I don't know how much longer we'll be able to hold on up here. Caregiving is being a caregiver is one of the hardest jobs that I've ever done, and I'm used to moving big logs around, building bridges. But it is also one of the most fulfilling. You know, to go in and help her roll over to and turn her so that there's no bed sores and the articulator and to try to get her out of pain and just help her clean up after an accident. Take her down the hill so she can drive the van into town. It's sometimes I feel I can hear my voice getting a little cranky, and then I just say, fuck, hey, brother, man, no fucking way you can be cranky. And she's easy because she is so positive. And
that's huge, isn't it?
Yeah,
That's huge.
Yeah. Oh, fuck. And like she'll say, she says that, well, I can't help but be positive because that's my blood type. Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect. And we still laugh more than we cry. And we're into she's taken on new interests. She was the most active person that the last picture I have of her able-bodied is she was out weed whacking the farm. Had a big weed whacker strapped on her and friggin'. And the next day she was paralyzed. So there's some short videos if you want to see what she looks like and how she's doing on my Facebook deal.
Oh, yeah, I'll look for that.
There's a couple of nice ones from Queens. One of my favorites from Queens was our first date after 3 weeks in the hospital. And we finally were going to get to go down to the cafeteria. She was going to get out of her room. We were going to get go down to the cafeteria. And that was just funny. And it was just it's a funny that I watch it when I start getting depressed. It was like 40 seconds long. You know, so it is what it is. You know, financially, we took a big, she was 50% of our income. When she went thud, that all changed. I'll tell you a little story. So it's like day four. And she'd just been into 7 hours of surgery putting steel plates in her back so that she wouldn't be like Raggedy Ann. And I'm sitting there, and she's just starting to wake up a little bit from surgery. And she looks at me, and she mumbles, there's $60,000 buried in the backyard. I said, what? She said, there's $60,000 buried in the backyard. I like, shoot, don't, you know, you just got out of surgery and you still don't. I said, just go to sleep. She went back to sleep. About 3 or 4 hours later, she wakes up, and I said, Chu, did you tell me there's $6,000 buried in the backyard? And she said, no. I told you there was $60,000 buried in the backyard. And I said, what the fuck? What are you talking about? And it turns out that she had been putting, since she started her job at the coffee shack, she had been putting $10,000 a year on average and burying it in the backyard.
Wow.
I know. I know. She says, follow the ohia tree roots. The ohia tree growing on the big rock. Follow the roots down to the ground. Look under there, there's a ledge, and in there is an ammo can, and it's got $60,000 in it. And sure enough, and that was just, it was like she was, had a feeling that we were going to need this sometime or another. And it just, it just absolutely saved us, you know. Wow. I mean, it was like, okay, because it was over in Honolulu, man. You're bleeding $300 a day easy.
Yeah, yeah.
And Seattle, and, you know, just, and her not working anymore. And
right.
Needing all this stuff to refit a house. And so that was huge. And that was just a story that, you know, is just, it summarizes her.
Nice.
It's. Yeah, it was. It was just, it was incredible. And then all the other stuff that came along with that, you know, we've always been generous people. Every time I travel, I try to find one person and depending on what they need, you know, get it for them. In fact, I bought my first wheelchair in Phnom Penh. The tuk-tuk driver I was telling you about has a son that had polio. And he showed me pictures of his family and you know, lived in a little house and just outside of Phnom Penh. And he said, yeah, this kid's on crutches going down dirt roads. I just need to get a wheelchair, and as soon as I can get a wheelchair, it's really going to help him, you know, go to school and all this shit. And I said, well, where do you get a wheelchair in Phnom Penh? And I just told him, take me there. And we went over, and, you know, I think it cost, in Phnom Penh, it cost me $130 to turn some person's life totally around.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And yeah. And so now neither one of us is ready to friggin' feel that that it's the end of the world because this happened. We don't have that feeling whatsoever. We went up to a hotel with Charlo and some other people and spent a night or two over Valentine's.
Cool.
Got in the pool and she's just swimming around with water wings on her legs so she doesn't just... She's so fucking funny. I mean, she's just so funny and just always fucking smiling. And, yeah. Yeah, it's been fucking great.
It's, you know, it's just interesting thinking about moving on with what life deals you, as the Vietnamese have done, as the Cubans have done, as you and Jay have done. It's just a real fascinating journey, as you and your brother did after you came back from Vietnam.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, you just gotta, you know, there's just, what else you gonna do? You know, you're gonna move on. We've met some people in the para community, in Washington and over here, and a lot of them are just so blown away by Chu that they would say, you know, after I got hurt, I spent a year in my house before I could come out, force myself to come out. And that was the kind of the prevailing stories that we heard. And the day she got out of rehab, she was out. She was out on the streets, and she was trying to get on with her life. And, you know, whether we make it here, we live on the side of a volcano. And, you know, we might end up selling it, which I don't think is going to be very hard. We've got realtors saying we got buyers and we don't have any properties. People are looking for this kind of lifestyle. Totally off the grid. Catchment water, solar power, more fruit than avocados and such than you can eat, you know? No bills. Zero bills. That's the only thing saving us right now. We've got zero bills. We don't have utility bills. We don't have car bills. We don't have a mortgage. We don't have... So, then we might find ourselves back in Washington State or something, you know, in the next couple of years. Hard to say.
Well, Richard, this has just been an incredible interview and an incredible interview series. And I want to thank you so very much for taking the time to do this with me. And this has just been a really wonderful interview series.
I've enjoyed it. Like every Sunday morning for 9 weeks in a row, you know, like talking to your mother.
Well, you're very kind because you had a very nice, a very incredible relationship with your mother. So, it's a wonderful deal.
Hey, can I read a couple of things?
That would be awesome.
Because they're both, they're addressed to Sarah and I. And that was when we retired the first time, and some people. I just want to get a couple things in there, just have them part of my record that I can shoot off to my troubled grandson.
That'd be cool.
Okay, let me get some glasses. Here we go. Dear Richard and Sarah, how unique, how exciting. Only you two could pull this off. The rugged backwoodsman, the cheery waitress, leaving the whole shebang behind and venturing forward to be coffee barons on a plantation in the Hawaiian jungle. Wow. We, more traditional, read boring types, retire in the usual haunches, near grandkids, in retirement communities, etc., and experience high adventure vicariously through individuals like you two beautiful people. I remember meeting you, Richard, in the canyon and liking you immediately. You fully expected not to like us, as we were the first, or one of the first, VIPs to boondoggle our way down the river. But to our good fortune, you accepted us as real folks. Then there you were, this rugged dude, hippie guy in Port Angeles buying a Victorian house. A Victorian house and fixing it up. And as I looked around your house, got to know you better, and looked around your heart, I discovered one wonderful fellow who gives to others in a unique way. One of the things I always wanted to do with you was to hang out at the Millionaires Club in Seattle and pass around a bottle of Jack Daniels to keep the street folks' innards warm and spirits up during the holiday season. But alas, being the soup's wife, a middle-aged woman, and all that rot, I didn't ask if I could join you and the grateful guys. There was a period before you met that beautiful blonde when we met in the grocery store, and you were pondering over what in the hell you were doing in a grocery store, plopping groceries in a shopping cart to haul them to your mortgaged home. You had joined the great middle class horrors. You said you might pack a few belongings and head for Mongolia, become a horseman of sorts. Well, about that time, Miss Sarah gave you one of her dazzling smiles as you were brooding over a brew at the Whacker, and the rest is history. I've always appreciated that you've kept in touch with Bob. He admires and is probably a little envious of you and your unique spirit, and you know how I feel about you, X's and O's. So here's a toast with Jack Daniels and a cup of Canopy Coffee to you two. Much happiness, adventure, and a bumper crop every year. Love, Mitzi. And that's Mitzi Chandler. Bob Chandler's wife.
Wow.
And then Bob kind of summed up my Park Service career. Mitzi and I want to wish you and Sarah the very best as you move on to the new chapter in your lives. It will be a great adventure. As I look back on my NPS career, I count you among those I call a friend. You have served the outfit with distinction in a very specialized field. When we leave a career, most of us like to know we have made a difference. There is no question in your case you did. The trails, bridges, and other improvements which were developed under your leadership served as a testament to your skill and ability in doing quality work. For years to come, millions of park visitors who will hike the trails at Grand Canyon and Olympic will benefit from your good work. You must feel a sense of pride in knowing you left your mark and set a standard for others to follow. I remember our first meeting on the Colorado River 16 years ago. You and Crumbo had hiked down from the North Rim to join a Ranger River patrol. Mitzi and I were aboard as guests. We sat around that evening sharing a bottle of Jack you had brought along to smooth those aching joints. I still see you in baggy shorts and flip-flops telling stories in your unique head-bobbing way. Little did we know we would develop a lasting friendship. And that was Bob.
Cool.
And yeah, you know, and the thing is, I got a shit ton of these letters, man. I was reading through them going, man, I'm glad I saved some of this stuff.
That was a really nice letter from Mitzi. That's just really touching.
Yeah. Yes, it was.
Very cool.
Well, shoot, let's not lose contact.
Absolutely. Let's stay in touch. We've got some more work to do, and that'll be fun. And I think with that, we'll go ahead and conclude part 10, unless you've got anything else to go in here.
No, I think that's good.
All right. Well, with that, this will conclude part 10 of Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Richard Hansen. Today is Sunday, February 21, 2021. My name is Tom Martin. And Richard, again, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your taking the time to do this.
said, for me, man, it was like, I think you can tell things in public easier than you can tell them in private, if that makes any sense. You know, there's some things here that my daughter probably hasn't even heard of. Some of the troubled times. And I think being able to be open and to go ahead and tell your story, that this was a lot easier for me than trying to sit down and tell somebody, you know? I mean, it's just, I think you can be freer when you're just sending it out there to the universe than you can if you have to look somebody in the eye and try to talk to them. That's my feelings. And so I've taken this opportunity to do that. And I've told you before, your questions, your voice, your preparation has always been first class and has made it easy for me to be forthright.
Well, I'm very grateful for your participation, and I look forward to staying in touch with you on the road ahead.
All right.
All right. Thanks, Richard.